Welcome to Irish Passport.
Let's do it.
Welcome to the Irish Passport.
I'm Tim McInerney.
I'm Naomi O'Leary.
We're friends.
Okay, well to Naomi.
Anwar Fad, Tim.
This is your passport to Irish culture, history and politics.
Uh-huh.
I'm recording.
One, two, three. Okay.
Gronya weleg chachtar solya ogli arm halehi mar gorda gwelid fein is nigol no spani is karishi adruig er golif o roche the vaha walya o roche the vaha walya o roche the vaha walya Anisher hachton tauri Vwilarin of Yartka vecum Aramean bio in a year Ach shachton groan you will Is mila gashkiach Eg for
Hello everyone and welcome back to the Irish Passport Podcast.
Hi listeners.
You were just listening to one of Ireland's most iconic rebel songs, O Roisí de Bheatha Bhaile. Famously, it talks about the Gaelic leader Gráinne Mhaoil coming home from across the sea to liberate Ireland from foreign invasion. We're going to talk a little bit about Gráinne Mhaoil later on and that song as well, and that's because this song references the very period we've been talking about in our recent Conquest mini-series. In this series, we've been exploring the Elizabethan conquest of Ireland in the 16th century, and this is the third instalment. So if you're new to the podcast, you're definitely going to need to go back and listen to our previous two episodes before you join us for this one, because there's a lot going on in this history.
Yeah, there's so much going on in this history, Naomi, and we have loads more to cover in this once again. This is going to be a long one, but a good one, I promise, because we are finally getting to the great uprising of Gaelic clan chiefs against English occupation in the 1590s. This is the conflict now known as the 9 Years' War.
Right, so this is the big one, everyone. All right, Tim, So where do we start?
Okay, I know exactly where we need to start right off the bat. Because we need to really hammer home how momentous this history was,
yes.
Obviously, for Ireland. This whole history is very momentous for Ireland. But this history was momentous for England as well. And that's something that's less known. I mean, not many people around the world will even have heard of this war. Mm. I would wager even that a lot of people who know quite a bit about Elizabethan England, they probably haven't heard of this war at all, maybe, or don't know very much about it.
It's entirely possible.
Extremely possible. If you read modern histories about this, you would get the impression that this is a kind of minor skirmish in the background of the Tudor world. But this couldn't be further from the truth at all.
Well, this came up actually in one of our Patreon debriefs that we record as bonus stuff for our supporters. Mm. You get this impression from like the popular historiography of Elizabethan England that Ireland was a kind of minor annoyance, that, you know, it was kind of at worst distracting Westminster from other graver, more important concerns, but ultimately not of great significance in the grand scheme of things. And that's coming through modern eyes, right? It makes more sense if we think that a lot of the popular images that we have of the Elizabethans, they were set down in the 19th century. And that was an era when that was how many people in Britain thought about Ireland. But back in the actual Elizabethan era, as you say, Tim, the reality was very, very different.
Yeah, it was so different. I would go so far as to say that you actually can't understand Elizabethan England at all without understanding this war and the sheer magnitude of this war that it was waging in Ireland. Because it shapes so much of the state's policy and its military strategy and its finances and its economy even at this point. There's a very good reason why we keep running into these famous Elizabethan figures in this history. You know, every now and again, right, we run into a Drake or a Spencer or a Devereux or a Sidney, etc. These people keep popping up, and that's because anyone who was anyone at the highest levels of the English court was involved with this. This war in Ireland was the war of their time, of their generation. In fact, Westminster poured so much money into the war against Gaelic Ireland that it almost bankrupted the English state.
Wow.
Like, this was by far and away the most expensive war of the period. In terms of cost, it outstripped by many measures all of the other wars that England fought in Europe during Elizabeth's reign, including big iconic moments like the Spanish Armada. Like, this was far, far, far more expensive.
Can you give us an idea, like, what scale of money are we talking about here?
I actually can. I can give you a very good idea, actually. So, remember the Desmond Rebellions that we talked about in our last installment? Mm. So, rising up, all the old English lords rising up in Munster. That went on for 10 years. It was pretty extensive. It involved this campaign of mass starvation. It involved the mass plantation of thousands of people, things like that. It was a big war, right? That cost the crown about £250,000 at the time, which was a very expensive war at that time. If we take the 9 years' war against Hugh O'Neill, which also it was less than 10 years that this took, that cost Elizabeth I over £2 million.
What? So that is actually just a vast figure for the time.
Yeah, like, this is almost fantastically huge. Like, the word million is not a word that you ever really hear in the vocabulary of early modern England. You know, you don't hear it in even the 17th or the 18th century very often either, because it's just, you just don't often see £1 million doing anything at this time, you know, let alone 2 million. And the economic damage here was potentially catastrophic for England. Like, £2 million was equivalent to about 40 million days worth of wages for a skilled worker. Let's put it in that way. Right? So this went to the extent that taxation might have had to be increased across the country just to pay for this war, that there might have had to be an artificial inflation of the currency to try and pay for this war. Like, this was massive. And £2 million is actually the figure that we have from English estimates. And that was almost certainly played down for propaganda purposes. They were not going to tell everyone how much they had actually spent. So the real figure is likely to be far, far higher than that.
It was just a massive outlay that would have represented like an overwhelming policy, I guess, by the state at that time.
Yeah, this huge investment, this gamble, I suppose. This 9 years' war, it also ate up more soldiers than any other English war of the time. Mm. At certain points, there were up to 18,000 English troops fighting in Ireland. That dwarfs the figure for other English armies at war in Europe at the time.
Okay. And I suppose the more money that England lost in Ireland, the more money they felt they had to spend in Ireland, because it was like kind of they were in so deep. Like, the only chance they had to recoup the losses was to make sure that they gained access to the Irish lands and resources in the end.
Yeah, sure. Right. In for a penny, in for a pound, or £2 million, as the case may be. Right. And of course, there's this whole other dimension to this chaos as well, because this war, like England's war in Ireland, also took center stage in the context of the European wars of religion at this point. Mm. So this, we have to understand as we're going through this history, this was in every way a European war. In fact, this was one of the most significant wars in Europe of the 16th century. Everyone, all the powerful players in Western Europe anyway, had their eyes on what was going on here. Spain and France and Italy and everyone. Because the stakes were just so high for the future of the continent in what the result was.
Wow, okay, so let's have a look quickly at how this all started. Because amazingly, in lots of ways, it came down to the actions of one man. Mm. Listeners, at this stage, you'll be fairly well acquainted with Hugh O'Neill, the Gaelic ruler of Tyrone. The last time we saw him, Tim, he had defected from the English side and he had declared himself Taoiseach under Breton law. We also saw that by the 1590s, the English incursion into Ireland had stepped up significantly. So troops of colonial settlers known as the New English were arriving in the hopes of seizing vast tracts of land for private venture. And the whole Earldom of Desmond, for instance, was violently taken under English control in the 1580s and carved up into lots for colonial plantations. Similar plantation projects were underway on the east coast of Ulster, only a few kilometres from Tyrone. So it would have seemed inevitable to O'Neill and all the Gaelic clan chiefs around him that their territories were next. They were next in line for colonial plantation, whether they submitted to the authority of the English monarch or not. And it's around this time that O'Neill abandoned his allegiances to Westminster.
Yes, so this is the context in which O'Neill proclaims himself the O'Neill, so the chief of the O'Neill clan, in 1595. In other words, he's claiming authority in Ulster not by way of English law. So by English law, he was recognised as the Earl of Tyrone, Tyrone was their shire, as they called it. It was their legal jurisdiction. Uh-huh. But here he's recognizing his authority by Gaelic law, according to the Breton laws, by which he is Taoiseach not of Tyrone, but of this vast Ulster territory of Tír Eoghain, which is slightly different, even though it's Tyrone is clearly an anglicisation of Tír Eoghain, but they're different jurisdictions. By the way, Naomi, I'm making an executive decision to refer to O'Neill now by his Gaelic name from now on. Okay. We discussed this briefly in our last Patreon debrief. Hugh O'Neill's name was not actually Hugh. It was A. So he was born A. O'Neill. Hugh was an anglicisation. And in previous episodes, I decided to use Hugh because he grew up in the Pale with New English families. That's probably what everyone called him at that stage, what he called himself. But we can be pretty sure now that people around him in Tír Eoghain were calling him A. O'Neill again. In fact, he became known as A. Mór O'Neill, which means the Great O'Neill, the Great O'Neill. And, you know, a lot of these clan chiefs are called, let's say, A. Rua, because they have red hair. So that's Red O'Neill, or A. Bui, blonde hair. This isn't blonde, this isn't red, this is the Great O'Neill. So that gives you a bit of an insight into how he was perceived in Ulster at this point.
This is like a power rebranding, Tim.
Yeah. And while we're renaming him, actually, I think this is a perfect moment to talk a little bit about what he looks like. Mm. Because I have a great quote here from a chronicler of the time named Fiennes Morrison.
Okay.
We're going to be hearing loads of quotes from this guy. He was a personal secretary to one of the English Lord Deputies in Ireland, Lord Mountjoy. We're going to meet him later on.
Okay.
And Fiennes Morrison, this personal secretary, is like this horrible little snivelling sidekick character. He's like, oh, Lord Mountjoy, oh, you're so wonderful, master. He's horrible. He writes all of these awful things about the Gaelic Irish, like really, really awful things. We don't have time to get into here. But he also wrote this really extensive and informative first-hand account of the 9 Years' War. He was like right there in the action. It's called The History of the Rebellion of the Earl of Tyrone. And it was published in 1616. I will put a link up to the whole work on Patreon for anyone who's interested in reading it for themselves, because it's actually very readable and it's completely fascinating. But anyway, here is how Morrison describes A. O'Neill. So I'm going to send you that text now, Naomi.
Okay, bro. Here's the quote. He was of a mean stature, but a strong body. He was able to endure labours, watching and hard fare, being industrious and active, valiant, affable, and apt to manage great affairs, and of a high subtle dissembling. That means that it was hard to know what he was thinking. And of a profound wit. Many deemed him born either for the great good or ill of his country. Wow, it's really interesting character depiction. It's like very vivid, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And like especially written by his enemies, you know, these people really hated him, the ones who were writing it. I love that he was short, by the way. That's what they mean by mean stature. Not mean stature, but a strong body. He's like this pint-sized little muscly dude, I guess. It's a great detail about Hugh O'Neill.
And of great wit.
And great wit, yes. And this, I love this idea that whatever he's going to do, it's going to be either very, very good or very, very bad.
He's got some sort of destiny ahead of him. Fantastic.
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know what this is reminding me of? Alexander the Great. He was also called the Great. Oh, yeah. He was also short stature, but, you know, strong guy and, you know, strong character and so on. Anyway, so we left off at this amazing scene before where Aidan O'Neill goes to the ancient coronation site at Tulloch Oge, and he sits on the ritual Lachnari, a rock, and he assumes the title of Taoiseach. And I suppose that wasn't just a simple legal ceremony. It was also a spectacular piece of propaganda. All these other clan chiefs in the surrounding territories who were just as worried about the new English forces as he was would have seen this incredibly powerful player affirming himself as one of them and affirming the all-important territory of Tír Eoghain as under Gaelic authority.
It's really remarkable, and it had just as much of an impact on the English as it had on the Gaelic Irish. O'Neill had actually made loads of enemies in the Pale and in Westminster over the previous few years, especially. Loads of people had suspected that he was up to something for ages, right? Like not least Henry Bagginal. You might remember him, listeners. He was in charge of the English army in Ireland and he was sent to kind of keep an eye on O'Neill in Ulster. Mm. And in response to this narc being sent in to, you know, make sure that O'Neill was on the straight and narrow, O'Neill went and eloped with Bagginal's sister. Her name was Mabel Bagginal.
Wow, Mabel.
Mabel, yeah. And off they went and they got married and all kinds of things going on here.
And a personal beef, I guess, as well, over this affair.
Yeah, huge personal beef, yeah. And O'Neill seems to love torturing Bagginal whenever he can. Like, he did things like he wrote him letters saying, "You haven't sent me the dowry for the marriage yet." You know, when this guy is like, does not recognize the marriage and is going berserk about this. And so he's one of these people, Bagginal. The whole time, like for years, he is going to London, going to Dublin and saying, this O'Neill guy is up to no good. You cannot trust this guy. Something is up. But nobody listens to people like Bagginal because, remember, Westminster really depended on O'Neill as their ally in Ulster. Mm. He was their only real symbol of authority in that whole region. So he could kind of get away with all kinds of shenanigans and they would turn a blind eye because what else were they going to do? It also seemed to them that he was constantly proving his loyalty. He was fighting alongside them in basically every battle that they were waging with other Gaelic clans, or at least they believed that he was doing that.
You mentioned before that O'Neill was secretly tipping off the Gaelic clans in advance of the battles and stuff like that. So the English kept thinking they'd won strategic fights with the help of O'Neill, but the Gaelic clans were actually busy amassing like even more forces in a different location and stuff like that.
Yes. So this whole time from at least 1693, he's playing both sides of the field. Mm-hmm. Remember, O'Neill had been brought up in the Pale. He knew how to talk the talk. He knew how to walk the walk. It was easy to trust him, and Westminster so desperately wanted to trust him.
Right, right. So when he declared himself Taoiseach and it became obvious that he was in league with the other Gaelic chiefs of Ulster, it must have been a bit of a knife to the heart for a lot of people in the English court.
Yeah, it was a huge shock, even though, I mean, they had been warned. The Elizabethan court goes out of its mind about this. The English Privy Council described O'Neill as, I quote, that vile and base traitor who they had, quote, raised out of the dust. So that's a reference to the fact that they had taken him away from Gaelic Ireland and raised him as a civilized Renaissance man. And look what he did. He turned around. They call him the arch traitor. That's often how a lot of people just refer to him from this point on.
Oh my God. It's kind of complimentary, isn't it? Wow. From your enemies, like... So what is O'Neill's plan? When you think about the Desmond rebellions, those people had territory that was actually much bigger than Tyrone. And they also had massive armies that were well prepared to take on English forces. But they were completely annihilated, especially after the English scorched the earth and caused famine in the local population. So why would O'Neill think that it was going to work out differently for him?
Right. So this is a great question. And it's probably why this period is so beloved by military historians, because a lot of this comes down to the fact that O'Neill is a brilliant strategist.
Oh my God, he is, so, Alexander.
Yeah, I suppose he is. I mean, maybe let's not get ahead of ourselves because we'll see what happens to him. But there's three main things that make his situation different from what came before him. So first of all, Ulster, remember, was incredibly well defended by natural geographic barriers. So he has this natural fortress of Ulster. That reality hadn't changed. The English had never managed to lead a large-scale military invasion into Ulster, and into the interior anyway. And there was no reason why would they be able to do it any better now. Secondly, O'Neill had been secretly training one of the biggest armies in Ireland for years at this stage. And once again, he had capitalized on every advantage he had. So, as the Earl of Tyrone, the English had needed O'Neill to have an army. They needed him to have a pretty well-armed standing army in Ulster, because that was the whole point of him being there. You know, he was there to help them, to protect them. At the same time, the English didn't want O'Neill to have too many soldiers up there, because, as we know, lords in Ireland tended to get rebellious when they had too much power. So, they wanted Tyrone to be an asset, but not a threat.
Powerful enough to help the crown, but not to be a threat to the crown.
So O'Neill was allowed to have 600 soldiers at his command. That was it. And that was fairly generous in these circumstances. We have to remember as we go through this that populations at this point are really, really small. So entire armies are very often formed of just a few hundred people. This is a lot of people for the time, especially armed people. And if we kind of think about where we are, a lot of soldiers in the armies are coming from specific, you know, classes in society, you know, like these, this is a fairly exclusive rank relatively to the population. And this amount of people or his army, they would have been regularly inspected. That was the whole idea of sending in these new English governors like Bagginal. They would be coming around to your house and making sure that you didn't have a bigger army than you were allowed to have. And theoretically, O'Neill shouldn't have needed a bigger army than that, because his army was only there to assist the English in Ulster anyway, and not much else.
He's just supposed to like turn up for the battles whenever they say and that kind of thing.
Exactly, yes. However, he had been doing something very sneaky this whole time. He would take 600 of his tenants from among the local population, and he would train them to be soldiers in this army of 600 people. He would drill them, he would refine their skills, etc. And then after a few months, he would send them back home, back out into the fields, and take 600 new volunteers and start training them again.
Okay, so like he's swapping out his whole army in like rotation. He's like just quietly training everybody.
Exactly. And each time, like it's a whole new group of completely untrained novices. Okay. And he would train the hell out of them, right? You know, another 600 people for another few months. And then he would swap them out again.
So it always looked like he had 600 soldiers, but he had all these reserves. Like he had 600 currently mobilized soldiers. But then he had like, you know, tons of more reserves, but the inspectors just didn't know that.
Exactly. Yes. Because he just keeps the rotation going. Train a new generation of soldiers, swap them out with new recruits, train another generation, etc. So by the time it actually came to war, he actually had an army of about 6,000 people waiting to take up arms that nobody knew even existed. And this was like quite an innovative tactic for the time, by the way, because at this point, armies were usually made up of permanent soldiers, and these permanent armies would be supplanted with professional mercenaries, like the Galloglasses that we discussed last time. But the idea of putting all your tenants through like military service, you know, giving ordinary farmers this high level of military training and then sending them back to the fields, you know, until you need them, that was really unusual for the time.
That's super interesting. And consider it's actually a very modern concept if we think about it. People going into military service and so on in the general population. So, okay, if he was allowed only 600 soldiers, though, how would he arm all those extra people if he had tons of reserves?
Very good question. This is the best part. Yeah. So O'Neill keeps telling everyone that he was doing renovations on his house.
Okay. So,
loads of renovations. So we've seen some of these houses kind of pop up. So Thomas Butler, remember, he built like this big Tudor manor, the Earl of Ormond. And Edmund Spenser as well. He took over an old Fitzgerald castle and built a big Tudor manor as well. Right. They were building these mansions in Ireland, and that was really encouraged by Westminster, because the crown, the English government, saw this as like a civilizing influence. It was a symbol of political authority. It was helping to make Ireland more culturally English, and also like getting the message across to Irish people, like, we're in charge, you know?
Yes, yes.
So they loved this idea. And also, remember, A. O'Neill was an earl. So that's a pretty high-ranking title. And that was one of the perks of being an English noble. You get to build a big fancy home. And if you want, you know, to get people to give you loans, for instance, to help you do it, that's something that happens. It's for the dignity of the realm, let's say.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So O'Neill keeps telling Westminster that he's building this big house in Tyrone. They love this idea, and he gets a special permit to import loads of contraband building materials.
Ah, but a twist. This isn't iron for stairs or something. It's actually to be made into weapons.
This is to arm his secret army. Exactly. So here is a quote from Fiennes Morrison again, who was outraged by this trickery. I'm sending you this quote now.
Okay, here's what Fiennes Morrison says. When Tyrone first began to plot his rebellion, he is said to have used two notable practices. First, he trained all his men to perfect use of their arms. Secondly, pretending to build a fair house, which our state thinks a sign of civility, he got license to transport to Dungannon a great quantity of lead to cover the battlements of that house, but soon employed the same only to make bullets for the war. Oh, I was actually quite close to guessing it. I didn't know you put lead on battlements. So gas. Yeah. So yeah, they were thinking they were going to get this house of like projection of power and stuff, but actually he's just like salting it away and making bullets out of it.
So many of our listeners actually wrote into us making parallels with the War of Independence when we were talking about this last time. And this is a good one. It's like the rifles in the hat boxes during the War of Independence, right? This kind of thing. So the last big advantage that O'Neill has is his position as regards Gaelic and English military strategy. So let me explain. He knows both the Gaelic world and the world of the Pale pretty much like nobody else. He knows especially how both societies approached war, because this guy, he had actually grown up in Henry Sidney's house, for God's sake. Like, Henry Sidney was the literal Lord Deputy of Ireland who had designed this whole kind of apparatus of new English incursion into Ireland. O'Neill lived with him. Like, O'Neill literally grew up his most formative years with this guy. He knows what these people have in mind, that he knows the inside of their brain. But also, like, he was also a Gaelic boy. His childhood was in the Gaelic world, and he had returned to the Gaelic world. So he knew how the Gaels thought about war as well. And I think the most important facet of all that is that O'Neill knew what the English didn't know about Gaelic Ireland, if you get what I mean. Like, he knew which of their assumptions were wrong. He knew what they expected. He knew what they didn't expect of a Gaelic army. And therefore, he knew what their weaknesses were.
Very good. Yeah, he was like totally in their heads.
One thing that he took advantage of was the very, very widespread idea, especially among these newly arriving troops from England, that the Irish were just savages, right? That they were naked savages in the woods and wouldn't be able to put up much of a fight on a battlefield.
Okay.
Now, we need to kind of get into the heads of these soldiers at this point. This is the era of colonial settlement in the New World. There were these ideas like wafting all around England at this point that of like simple heathen natives, let's say, both in America and in Ireland. And all of these kind of images of like people from a primitive past somehow living like in the forests and trees. That's very much the stories that people would have heard at this point.
Right. And people who are very vulnerable. We caught a glimpse of that in our last episode, actually, with the colonial planter Thomas Smith. He talked about this simple Irish churls who he presumed would be happy to labour for civilised English settlers.
Yeah, right. So that was, for Thomas Smith, that was a huge weakness of his, because it was just a false assumption on his part, right? It was just an ignorant assumption, which left him very vulnerable in the end. And Thomas Smith was relatively informed compared to your average army recruit from Devon in 1595. And this just wasn't true. Like, these assumptions just weren't true. The Irish military strategy, first of all, like the native Gaelic military strategy, was different from the English military strategy for sure, but it was also incredibly effective against the English army and against traditional English warfare. Like, we can see this because the Irish had used it to keep the English settlers confined to the Pale for centuries. Like, they kept winning using these Gaelic military strategies. So they're like, there were nothing to be sniffed at, and they certainly weren't primitive. A second thing here is that Gaelic armies were well able to fight traditional field battles, like out in the open. This wasn't all just ambushes by any means.
Right. This is an untested territory. This is actually territory that's been tested repeatedly, and these armies are seasoned. It's not that they're, you know, completely naive and just going to be taken by surprise. O'Neill spots this, I guess. He knows that the common English stereotype of the Irish as primitive savages, this is a major weak point, because it means they won't be prepared for what they're actually going to face.
He also knows what works against the Gaelic armies. He knows the things that are going to work against them, where their military tactics have to be adapted. So O'Neill does something completely remarkable. This is amazing. He creates a new form of warfare. So he takes the most effective Gaelic tactics and the most effective English tactics, and he eliminates any tactics that he knows the English could take advantage of. He creates this like hybrid army of the best of both worlds.
Okay, fascinating. So lay it out for us. How does this work exactly? Give us an example.
In a nutshell, Gaelic armies consistently outmaneuvered the English army. This was a thing. So they were always like, they were faster than them. Their equipment was lighter. They could move more quickly. And that was their biggest advantage since always. But that meant that their weaponry had to be more limited, because the whole point of this is that you can't carry the same weapons with you.
Right.
So O'Neill, for instance, takes the most effective weapons that he knew the English used, certain types of swords, certain types of spears, certain types of axes, and then he makes like miniature versions of them so that the Gaelic army can use them, but they're smaller and they're lighter and they can stay fast. They maintain this advantage of speed, but they also have the same weapons as the English have.
Right. So they have the same like deadliness of weapons. He's setting up an army which is arguably technologically superior to the English army in Ireland.
Yeah, like not arguably. It was. There isn't much. Yeah. Like the Irish army under O'Neill was far superior to the English army in Ireland at this point. And he doesn't stop there. Like, he trains them in the most cutting edge new methods that are coming out of Spain and France at that point. Things that he knows the English army haven't been trained in, that haven't taken hold in England yet. Like, it really is remarkable. And he is doing this. He's making a better army than the English have in secret, completely in secret.
Fascinating. Okay, so how does this fit into the alliances that he was making with the other Tichy in Ulster? Like, how does that affect the dynamics of what's going on here? Did they feel threatened?
Yes. So this is, of course, another big aspect of all this. Tyrone was surrounded. It was this big old, powerful player in Gaelic Ireland, and it was surrounded by ancient rival clans that wanted its land, that wanted its resources. And historically, Tyrone was always going to war with these clans around it. And traditionally, the English would have capitalized on those rivalries. It's an obvious thing to do. Yeah. Try and get one clan or another to join the English side in exchange for assistance against another clan, like their old enemies. But the English had kind of ruined that advantage with these indiscriminate massacres that they kept pulling off. Like, think of people like Brian MacPhailam that we looked at in Clan Na Boy in our last installment. Someone who went on their side, someone who said, yeah, okay, I'm going to fight with you, the English. I recognize the queen and all that. And then they just kill him and they kill all his family, you know. So they ruin the advantage that can give you, because nobody wants or nobody trusts the English now enough to go on their side. Instead, what's happened now is all these clans suddenly have a common objective. They're all completely terrified of these incredibly violent new English armies. And they all want to prevent the English from gaining access to their territories. A lot of their territories, which have maintained very much their borders against them. So O'Neill recognizes this and he starts making alliances with these ancient rivals all around him.
Okay.
They're all called Hugh. Every Gaelic chief in Ulster is called Hugh. So they have little nicknames to distinguish them. So there's A. Rua O'Donnell. Aerua is Red Hugh, and he's the chief of Tir Conal. Now, that's modern-day Donegal, or most of it. And then there's A. Maguire. He was the chief of Fir Monarch, which is basically exactly the same territory as the modern-day county Fermanagh. These are his two main allies to begin with, anyway. And the deal was that every time the new English forces encroached onto one of their territories, the others would come and help them.
All the Hughes would get together and form one.
By the power of Hugh, they will repel them. Yeah.
Okay. And you mentioned the European wars of religion. How is that like overlaying onto this whole story?
Yeah. So this is where things really escalate from what it was before. So O'Neill is there with his little Gaelic alliance of Ulster chiefs. Now, they're powerful. That's a lot of people. But he knows he can't hold out like that forever. As long as the Elizabethan state exists, it's going to keep sending incursions into Ireland. Like, there is an inexhaustible source of new English adventurers who are just going to keep coming. They know that. So he and his allies start sending letters to sympathizers on the continent.
Okay.
Noble families, Irish people, maybe Irish people, business people on the continent, things like that. And they start trying to reframe this war of colonial resistance as a great European war between Catholics and Protestants.
Okay.
Now, this is new. This was a new way to look at this war. People had not been thinking about it like this, really, at all. Remember, even the Catholic Old English, they were generally, on paper, still loyal to the Queen, even though she was a Protestant. This wasn't a war between Catholics and Protestants at all at this point. And reframing this as a religious war is a kind of brilliant but completely cynical move on O'Neill's part.
Okay.
Famously, O'Neill was not interested in religion. He was not a religious guy. Like, he didn't go to church. He had, you know, he didn't pray. He didn't care. I think the Earl of Essex once joked that O'Neill was about as pious as his horse or something like that. Like, nobody took this seriously that he was religious. He just saw this as a way to amplify the Irish cause by times a million, because this was a way to get the attention of all of Catholic Europe onto what was otherwise maybe quite a local conflict. Mm-hmm. And not least, he starts writing personally to who was then the most powerful monarch in the world, King Philip of Spain. Mm-hmm. O'Neill writes a series of letters to Philip and basically says that if Philip sends assistance to Ireland, he would be securing the Catholic religion, not just in Ireland, but in all of Europe. So here's one of those letters. I'm going to send it to you now. There you go, Naomi.
Okay, so here's what Aidan O'Neill writes to the King of Spain. Our only hope of re-establishing the Catholic religion rests on your assistance. By the timidity or negligence of the messengers, our former letters have not reached you. We therefore again beseech you to send us 2,000 or 3,000 soldiers with money and arms before the feast of St. Philip and James. With such aid, we hope to restore the faith of the church and to secure you a kingdom. Gosh. He's appealing to the enemies of England. Yeah, offering kind of Ireland as like a new front, I guess. And it's not so long after the Spanish Armada had attempted an all-out invasion of England. So, you know, this is potentially quite a powerful scenario, disastrous for Westminster. It's kind of like their worst nightmare. They'd always lived in fear of the Irish and the Spanish working together to attack England through the back door. And I guess Aidan O'Neill would have been well aware of that better than anyone.
Yeah, he's advertising Ireland basically to Philip, saying like, this is your chance, now or never. I like the little detail there, by the way, that he says, we sent you a few messages earlier. Doesn't look like you replied. So just following up on this, Philip. Yes. So he's clearly been really bugging him, right? And he gets his attention eventually. This levels the whole conflict up to this whole new stage. There's a funny detail to this, by the way. There was actually a long tradition in Gaelic Ireland, under this world of Gaelic Ireland, that the Irish themselves were Spanish in origin, that they had originally come from Spain. There was this ancient origin myth that claimed that the Gaels were descended from the Milesians, who had come from the Galician city of Coruña.
Okay.
And this was a thing that people believed. It was just like that the Irish and the Spanish were ethnically the same people somehow.
Okay.
And because of this, there was quite a lot of interest among Gaelic chiefs in becoming Spanish. Like, they were not against that idea at all, in accepting the Spanish king as their monarch and becoming citizens of Spain. Like, that was absolutely an option here. And it's something that O'Neill hints at as well, is like, if you help us, maybe you can become the King of Ireland.
Yeah, he says that, like, we would offer you a kingdom or whatever. Yeah, it's kind of quite explicit. Yeah.
That's exactly what he's getting at. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, this might sound counterproductive, but this would be pretty practical. It was certainly preferable to the status quo right now, right? What was happening to them under the English crown with, you know, just English armies coming in and massacring them all on a regular basis.
So interesting. It kind of reminds me of the reference to our gallant allies in Europe that's in the proclamation in 1916. I'd be so interested also to know, like, what was the Spanish perception of Ireland at this point? Because I'm not sure. I wonder, whether it would be like they don't seem to be too enthusiastic. So it would be interesting to know.
At the beginning, it very much is Ireland who, right? You know, they're not interested. But eventually they start to say, you know, people like O'Neill have a real point. This is an opening. This is an in. This could be a real thing. And we'll see that happening later on. So Fiennes Morrison actually mentions this whole Gaelic-Spanish like affinity thing in his account. So he says, I quote, "Thus the fire of this dangerous rebellion is now kindled, stemming from the hatred of the conquered against the conquerors, the difference of religion, and the love of the Irish to Spain, whence some of them are descended. And this fire of rebellion now kindled shall be found hereafter to be increased to a devouring flame."
Wow. That's such an enduring idea about the descent, Spanish descent thing as well, because that's come up repeatedly in this podcast, actually.
Yeah, it has. There's a real line there. There's a real kind of cultural repetition there. Yeah. So what happens now is that the Gaelic Alliance starts sieging English forts and outposts at the edge of their territories and turning them into defensive strongholds. Mm-hmm. Basically, they're using these English outposts to keep the English out. So like invading them, taking control, and then using them as their own outposts.
Okay.
In 1598, Henry Bagenal, who is O'Neill's brother-in-law, we can't forget, leads this massive army of 4,000 men, huge army, including more than 300 cavalry and entire sets of artillery machines. He leads them from the Pale into Ulster to retake the most important of these forts. It's on the River Blackwater, which kind of runs basically along the border of Ulster. Mm. Now, in normal times, this would have been a slam dunk. Like, 4,000 people is a huge military force. The main thing Bagenal would have been worried about was being ambushed in the countryside along the way. So you'll remember that it's trying to get into the interior of Ulster that's dangerous, right? You're surrounded by mountains and bogs and forests. And normally you would be attacked during this point. But when Bagenal approaches to retake this fort, it doesn't happen. So he's marching his army through the forest, through the mountains.
As you do,
you know, huge 4,000 troops. And everything around him is strangely quiet and peaceful. Now, if we were in a Hollywood film, Naomi, we would be able to warn him. But unfortunately, he doesn't know. He doesn't know about dramatic tension. So after a few days march, nothing happens. They get to their destination. They can see the fort. They just have to cross this area of raised bogland to get to this fort. And this raised bogland is known as the Yellow Ford, because it was covered in heather brush, and heather brush is covered in yellow blooming flowers in autumn. And when they get there, they discover this weird thing. They find out that the Gaelic Irish have dug this defensive ditch across their path. So it's this really long defensive ditch. It just keeps going. It's more than a meter deep. It's been filled up with these sharp thorn bushes. And this was a typical Gaelic defense structure. We talked about how they modify the landscape like booby traps in previous episodes. But there was nobody around to defend this ditch. It was like, all right, you know, everyone had a bit of a laugh. They put down some planks and they just crossed this ditch, right? You know,
okay,
no problem. We can actually get past this. We're just going to step over it. Now, the heavier horses and the artillery, they can't cross these planks. So they have to stay, they have to wait behind for the moment on the other side of the ditch. But all of the foot soldiers, like the bulk of the army of the foot soldiers, cross over and make their way to the fort. And this is when O'Neill strikes. This whole time, the army had been worrying about ambushes from the woods, from the trees, small bands of woodcairns, etc. But the reality was so different, they had no idea. O'Neill had led the English army into an elaborate trap. Surrounding this whole area of the Yellow Ford was a Gaelic army of 5,000 soldiers, 1,000 more than Bagenal's own army. And remember, his one was supposed to go and crush this small band of insurgents.
Yes.
And O'Neill's army, these 5,000 people, almost all of them, I think it's something like 80%, had a rifle. They had guns pointed on the English army. And they emerge from the brush. They've all been in the brush just waiting this entire time. And they start firing on Bagenal and his army. And this causes panic, of course. So panic breaks out everywhere amongst the army and everyone starts fleeing in the opposite direction. But of course, they're fleeing towards the ditch.
Right.
That trench full of thorns, it wasn't there to keep them out. It was actually there to keep them in.
Oh my gosh.
They stampede themselves into the ditches until it was full to the brim with bodies of English soldiers.
Oh my God.
And the death toll for this attack, this battle, was cataclysmic for the time. Somewhere between 1,300 and 1,500 of Bagenal's soldiers were killed. That represents a third of his whole army. Like, this did not happen at the time. If you look at death tolls for battles at this time, it's more like 150 people, 250 really? People. You know, this is the kind of thing we normally look at. 1,300, this is just such a disaster for Bagenal. And Bagenal's killed himself. He gets shot through the head.
Gosh.
300 more of his army, the survivors, 300 just abandon him and go and join O'Neill.
Okay.
It's just like, well, we're not on the right side.
They must be Galaglasses or someone, are they? They're mercenaries, maybe.
Exactly. Yes, we mentioned this. Yeah, I think in the last episode. They're probably mercenaries, maybe Galaglasses. Yeah, and they just abandon the English army and they join O'Neill. So O'Neill gets 300 more soldiers. Okay. And then they hold up the remaining 2,000. The remaining 2,000 survivors surrender to O'Neill's army. They're stripped of all their weapons. O'Neill takes all their guns, all their horses, all their artillery, everything they have, and then he sends them marching basically naked back to Dublin in complete humiliation.
Wow, what a scene. It's so, that ditch is so sinister, that like flipped perception where it was actually to keep them in. Oh my God. And I was just thinking, I was like, oh, they're definitely going to lose all of their stuff here in this scenario. Like, they're definitely not walking away with it.
Right. Again, why isn't anyone made a film about this yet? I don't know. I didn't even have to work on the dramatic tension there. It just happened anyway. So listen, that's a dramatic moment, but it's also just hugely consequential. Like, it's hard to overestimate how consequential this was because O'Neill had unveiled himself at the Yellow Ford. He had unveiled that, by the way, I have a massive, fully equipped, professional, modern European army that is on par with anything you might have in the continent of Europe. And you're going to have to deal with this now. Like, we are different than what you thought we were.
Right.
And it had just annihilated one of the biggest ground forces that England had in Ireland. Like, it just destroyed them. And it was bulked up now with all of England's best weapons. And they had killed the Lord Deputy. Like, they shot the Lord Deputy through the head, right? This is how Fiennes Morrison describes his moment of turnaround. I'll send you that quote now.
Okay. Fiennes Morrison says, "The English, from their first arrival in that kingdom, never had received so great an overthrow. The Irish kerns were at first rude soldiers, but now they were grown ready in managing their pieces, and they became so disastrous to the English and successful in action that they shaked the English government in this kingdom till it tottered and wanted little of fatal ruin." This was like a profound blow.
Profound blow. He is not exaggerating at all. Actually, Fiennes Morrison's descriptions of things are fairly reliable, even though he's a horrible, snivelling little thing. what does happen now is completely extraordinary. Word spreads about this victory at Yellow Ford, and Gaelic clans start rising up all over the country. Now they know that O'Neill has this army. Everyone over Ireland starts declaring their allegiance to A. O'Neill. First of all, the alliance spreads into Connacht. The clans in Connacht, which of course borders Ulster in the west, start saying, "We join you. You know, we will join you as well." Then the clans in Leinster start joining them. And then, most spectacularly, there is this groundswell massive uprising in Munster.
And this is really significant because we saw in our last episode that Munster had recently been the scene of this incredibly devastating violence, starvation and colonization. And English adventurers had literally scorched the earth there, leading to a catastrophic famine and a massive population decline. The old Norman lordship of Desmond had been carved up into lots and sold off to colonial planters and their families, who'd been shipped over from England in their thousands.
As you say, Munster had been completely decimated. The Gaelic economy there had been completely destroyed. The population collapsed through murder, disease, starvation. All the infrastructure had been destroyed. You know, and the people there would have been profoundly traumatized.
Right.
And on top of there, you have this, you know, for the last, what, I don't know, where are we now? The 1590s. Yeah, for about 10 years now, you have a new social order that had been imposed there. All of these colonial planters, about 5,000 people farming the land, speaking English, trying to spread Protestantism, farming the land in new ways, you know, in English ways, establishing English towns, establishing these completely alien ways of life. Munster had become unrecognizable from what it had been before this.
I suppose you could say that the place had been colonized in the modern sense of the word. Like, these territories had been cleared and rebuilt to look and feel like a little piece of England.
Yeah, they really had. You know, this was the forerunner of, let's say, the plantation of Ulster. And it was fairly similar at this point. But all of that was going to change now, in this instant. So in Munster, where you would have thought the population, the Gaelic population, was at its weakest, the uprising of Gaelic locals was more ferocious than anywhere else. And I suppose the whole region just rose up in a bloodthirsty revenge, considering what happened to them. So an estimated 9,000 local men took up arms in the region, and they started brutally attacking the English plantations that had been set up there. They burned everything in their sight. They killed everyone that they came across, any planter anywhere across the whole province. The thousands of planters that had been given land in Ireland either got murdered or they fled. They fled their farms and they went to the walled cities and the towns, and a lot of them got straight on boats, went back to England and never came back to their holdings ever again. Wow. So they're completely run off. Like, that entire plantation of Munster was run out of Munster in entirety. This is how Fiennes Morrison describes the scene. Here's a quote for you, Naomi.
Okay. "The Munster rebellion broke out like lightning, for in 1 month's space, almost all the Irish were in rebellious arms, and the English were murdered or stripped or banished. The infection did more and more spread itself, for in the hearts of the seditious, there wanted not many strong motives, not least the hatred which the Geraldines bear to those English undertakers who possessed their ancestors' lands." So it's like you said, Tim, you know, they had a lot of grievances, and they seem to have just, this big defeat of the English at the hands of O'Neill seems to have just gotten rid of their fear, or acted like a signal.
Yeah, that seems to be it. It gave the green light. It said, just go for it. And I mean, we've looked at this scenario, I suppose, a lot in the past when we look at the context for uprisings like this in Ireland, big, huge community violent uprisings. And very often it's in cases like this where the locals have been left with nothing else to lose. You know, this is often where it is the most total uprising, where really you've brought them to such a low point that what else is there to do? Just go on a violent rampage and take out all of your revenge, you know, on these settlers. Yes. So, like I said, basically the whole plantation of Munster is burnt to the ground during this uprising. That's everything the English had worked on for the past 20 years or so. The whole point of the crushing the Desmond Rebellion pretty much puffed into air, into smoke.
Right.
And one of the people, by the way, who gets shunted out of Ireland at this point is one particularly reviled new English planter that we talked about, Naomi, in Munster.
I know, it's the unhappy genocidal poet, Edmund Spenser.
Yes, indeed. Listeners, you might remember I said keep an eye on Edmund Spenser's castle in our last installment, because he built a big Tudor mansion that he had renovated, one of the old Fitzgerald tower houses, and he built a nice big Tudor mansion that was burned to the ground by these rebels in Munster. The ruins that you can still see today, they're at Kilcolman, are the ruins of that being burnt out by O'Neill's forces. So Spenser, Edmund Spenser, who had, for memory, in case anyone has forgotten, who had advised systematic famines being spread out throughout the entire country, he himself had to flee for his life back to England, and he died the next year.
Let me find the world's tiniest violin.
Yes, let's all have a moment for Edmund Spenser. Right. Okay. Now, another really interesting thing is that O'Neill reasserts the ancient rights of the Norman Fitzgeralds over Munster. He's all the time trying to flirt with the old English during the 9 Years' War, saying, "Hey, old English, why don't you join us?" You know, he proclaims the Earldom of Desmond to be in existence again. He says, "This is no longer the plantation of Munster. This is the Earldom of Desmond." And now all the Desmond Fitzgeralds are dead, of course, so he has to find a relative. The surviving relative in the line is a guy called Seamus FitzThomas.
Okay.
He becomes known as An Siúlagán. Siúlagán means the pretender.
Ooh, and I love a pretender.
Yes, I love a good pretender. So Seamus An Siúlagán FitzThomas takes over the Earldom of Desmond. He starts calling himself the Earl of Desmond again, you know, without the permission of the crown, who is supposed to be in charge of that, and takes de facto or at least symbolic possession of the whole of South Munster again.
This must have seemed like total chaos for the English administrators. Like, what? Mm-hmm. The Desmonds are back. Didn't we kill all of them? Like, how is this happening? Everything's falling apart. They found a nephew. Like, what? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It is complete pandemonium. And I think there's no better illustration of that than someone that we have to mention, who is Grainne Whale. So you remember that from the song at the very beginning of the show.
Mm-hmm. So listeners may be familiar with Grainne Whale. She's quite an iconic figure. And I probably should use her English name in case people know her that way. The pirate queen, Grace O'Malley, is how she's sometimes known as well. So Gronuaile is the effective chief of the Oamolla clan territory, which is coastal. It's along the western coast of County Mayo, a stunning landscape. It's full of little inlets and islands. This is very much a boat-based kind of power base. Still today, it's an incredibly rich fishing ground. That was the main business of the Oamolla family. So the land in this region is quite mountainous and rocky, and it's not very good for cattle farming. So their real power was held on the sea.
Yeah, so the Oamolla built a whole series of castles along the Atlantic coast of Connacht. Mm-hmm. And that was a way to ensure that they had control over these fishing waters in that region. So if you've been to the west of Ireland, to Mayo or to Galway, you've probably seen about 6 different castles that are called Gronuaile Castle. I mean, if not 20 different castles, because like there are loads of them, and they really are all her castles, because she just had a lot of castles all along the coast. That's how they worked.
Gronuaile is actually a nickname. She was born Gronia ni Malia. And the story goes that as a little girl, she was forbidden from sailing with her brothers because her hair might get caught in the ropes of the ship. So she cut off all her hair and she got the name Gronuaile. It literally means Gronia the Bald or Bald Gronia. As an adult, she took control of the Oamolla clan, even though, according to tradition, only a man could be Taoiseach. And she went on to marry 2 of the most important figures in the region. First, the Taoiseach of the O'Flahertys of Iar Connacht, and then the Lord of the Norman Burke dynasty, Richard on Éireann, which means Iron Richard. These people have cool names. Bald Gronia and Iron Richard. Yeah. Yes.
They do have cool names. Like we had to mention these names like Iron Richard, which also reminds me, by the way, Naomi, I can't believe I'm mentioning it again, but do you remember in Game of Thrones there were some islands in the west called the Iron Islands, controlled by a woman pirate leader?
That's so true. Oh my God, what is going on here?
Yeah, just throwing that out there. we've wasted enough airtime on Game of Thrones, so I'll just leave that insinuation just right there. Yes. Anyway, so Gronia, the very real person, Gronuaile, had no interest in joining forces with O'Neill, actually. That wasn't her gig. That wasn't her thing. Mm-hmm. Partly because she didn't need to. Her territory in West Connacht was so remote that the English had never really taken an interest in it. Like, remember, you know, her power came from the sea. The land on her territory was like the least desirable land in Ireland. It was windswept. Mm-hmm. It was rocky. It had this poor acidic soil. Nobody wanted to make a plantation there. It was very difficult to get to. So she didn't really have to worry about any of these new English incursions. But she was this big political player at the same time in this system. And she was having none of this whole new English adventurer business kind of just coming anywhere near her. So she starts to kick up a bit of a fuss at this stage too.
Right. I mean, there are so many stories about this woman. Notoriously, when the new English governor of Connacht arrested her brother and her son on suspicion of being rebels in 1593, she was so outraged that she got on her ship and she sailed all the way to London, right up the Thames River, to the royal palace to complain directly in person to Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah, right. And like you say, Naomi, like there's a ton of stories about her, many of which we will talk about in the debrief, actually. This is one subject for a debrief. We've got so many fun things to talk about in the debrief this time, by the way. Anyway, this is one of those stories that basically everyone in Ireland would know about her, and something that I've known, you know, since I was a child. But looking at this history, that image takes on such a new meaning in my mind now, when you consider the total chaos that was breaking out in Ireland at this time, like this momentous uprising. The English colonial project was on fire, like quite literally. Yeah. And you can just imagine this scene where this Gaelic ship comes sailing up the Thames in London, you know, with clan chiefs in their mantles and their long hair and their mustaches and this like boss woman at the helm, you know, coming up the Thames. Like, it must have just been so wild at the time. And just like, what the hell is this island beside us? Like, what is going on?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we do have to talk loads more about Gronuaile, and maybe we'll make an episode about her in the future, but we will talk about her in the debrief because she doesn't play a huge role here. But in that regard, I think she's a really powerful symbol of the sheer confidence at this moment that the Gaelic clans have. Like, they're not afraid to step right up to the throne of Elizabeth I and look her in the eye.
Fascinating detail as well. At least as far as I remember, of course, she would have been Irish speaking. So the common language that she would have had to speak to Queen Elizabeth was Latin. So they would have had that conversation in Latin. That, to me as well, tells you about the education of these people, you know? including this woman leader. So as you were saying, Tim, like she's really come to embody, like symbolically, this unshakable spirit of Gaelic Ireland during that colonial conquest. And we can see that in the song that we played at the start of the episode. The tune of O Roisin na Bhaile Valia is very ancient, but the modern lyrics are actually quite new. They were written by Pádraig Pearse in the early 20th century, and they're a kind of battle cry for the Irish Revolution. And in the song, Gráinne Bhéal becomes a symbol for Irish resistance over the centuries. So O Roisin na Bhaile Valia means welcome home, really. And the lyrics describe Gráinne Bhéal returning as the summer is coming once again.
O Roisin na Bhaile Valia, O Roisin na Bhaile Valia, O Roisin na Bhaile Valia, an isir hocht an tauri.
So the idea of the summer returning and that it's possible to overthrow occupation, even in the darkness of a time like the Tudor conquest, I guess that's like this enduring idea, enduring image. And the song was sung by the rebels of 1916 in the GPO at the center of their rebellion. It's kind of amazing to have that cultural memory like spanning right back to this moment of earlier conquest hundreds of years before.
So if we come back to O'Neill then at this point, by 1598, he is quite literally roving around the island of Ireland now, forging alliances with Gaelic chiefs everywhere he goes, coordinating armed forces, organizing battalions, bringing his armies in line with their armies. He even goes into the Pale. He has the audacity to bring his army right through the barriers of the Pale and starts talking to the Old English and say, you should join us. Like, you should absolutely join us. We're Catholic. You're Catholic. Remember, this is a war of religion, like quotation marks. And like almost every, he doesn't get the Old English on side. They won't listen to him at this stage. But in Gaelic Ireland, almost everyone goes with him. Because there is zero doubt at this moment that he's on the winning side. And at this stage, the combined Gaelic troops around the country amounted to somewhere between 20,000 and 30,000 soldiers. This is just this staggering number of soldiers to have at the time. And like, this is nothing like any amount of soldiers that have ever been sent to Ireland by the English. And remember, they're better armed and they're better trained. Now, not all of those men can be mobilized at the same time. You can't just send all of those to one battle. But it does mean that there are fighting men everywhere in Ireland on O'Neill's side.
And also, people are also expecting that the Spanish might arrive at any minute, right? So if that's going to be the case, then O'Neill would have seemed pretty much unbeatable.
Yeah, this is huge. This is a huge thing, looming thing. And Elizabeth has to do something about this like yesterday. Luckily, back in England, back in the London court, in the marbled halls of Elizabeth's wonderful palace at Whitehall, one of her most darling courtiers, all dressed up in white and pearls and a ruff and everything, he just tried to set the scene here. He comes to her and he says, Elizabeth, I'm the man for the job. I can subdue the Irish. Now, this was the Earl of Essex. You might think that you know this person. You don't. We talked about the Earl of Essex in our last episode. This isn't him. He died in 1575. Okay. That was the guy who massacred everyone at Clan de Boy. Lovely, lovely character. This is his more charismatic, new and improved son. It's the new Earl of Essex. He's Robert Devereux. Real charmer, total fashionista. Loads of fun pictures of him. Elizabeth adored him. So she listens. She gives Robert Devereux an army of no less than 16,000 men to go and crush O'Neill and his Gaelic army.
Okay.
Now, this is huge. Like, this is just massive to send an army out of the country of 16,000 men. If you think back to Bagenal's army in 1595 for a moment, that was a big force. It was 4,000 men. So imagine what it means, like, Elizabeth has quadrupled that number. This was the biggest army that had ever fought or would ever fight for England under Elizabeth's reign.
Wow.
The second biggest were in the Dutch Wars. So there were these huge wars that were going on in the Netherlands, and they only ever sent 12,000 to the Netherlands. Okay. So this was gargantuan. Now, to make a long story short, Essex arrives in Ireland with his mega army. He's pretty much guaranteed instant success. In they come, you can imagine everyone's faces with this, like, city's worth of people arriving on the shore all at once, all armed, waiting to take on the rebellion.
Yeah.
But the place has become so ungovernable at this stage that Essex doesn't really have a clue what to do. Like, he was sure he could handle this, but he can't. He arrives in the Pale, and the Pale is already completely under siege. The old English in there are already half wavering to O'Neill's side. And then when he ventures out into the countryside, he keeps having to fight off Gaelic armies everywhere. Like, they're absolutely everywhere, just attacking him, like, everywhere they go. So what he does is he has to leave a segment of his army in the Pale to secure the Pale. I mean, at least you got to keep the Pale going. And then every garrison he finds, he's got to leave, like, a bunch of soldiers there, right? Because these ones are under siege as well. And eventually he writes to Elizabeth in this complete tizzy. So here's a quote from his letter. It gives you an insight into what's going on. I'll send this to you now.
Okay, the Earl of Essex writes, "I dare begin to give your majesty some advertisement of the state of this kingdom. The people in general have able bodies by nature and have gotten ready use of arms. By their late success, they have developed boldness to fight with your majesty's troops. In their pride, they value no man but themselves. In their affections, they love nothing but idleness and licentiousness. In their rebellion, they have no other end but to shake off the yoke of obedience to your majesty and to root out all remembrance of the English nation in this kingdom." Gosh.
Right. This letter goes on for pages, by the way. Okay. And he goes on to say that the old English, like the Hiberno-Normans, are like, they're no help at all. Like, they're not helping us at all. They might even be aiding the Gaelic army, he says. Here's the next part of his letter. I'll let you read this part.
"The Irish nobility and lords of this country are divided from us in religion and are as absolute tyrants as any are under the sun. The towns, being inhabited by men of the same religion and birth as the rest, will furnish the rebels with all things that may arm them or enable them against the state. The wealth of the kingdom is almost all in the rebels' hands. If your majesty resolves to subdue the rebels by force, they are so many and so framed to be soldiers that the war of force will be great, costly, and long." Wow, so a bit of a reality check.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. He's saying, like, Elizabeth, think about this. Like, do you really want to continue along this course? Because this is not going to be good. He's basically saying we can't win. He's priming Elizabeth for something here. And he's certainly saying, I can't do this. And it turns out he was right. By the time he gets to Ulster, because he's had to leave so much of this mega army in different places, he only has 4,000 soldiers left to face off with O'Neill, which is, like, pathetic at this stage. And O'Neill, just with him at that moment, has about double that amount. Essex is so humiliatingly outnumbered that the Gaelic Irish don't even bother to attack him. Instead, A. O'Neill invites him to have a talk. Little Robert Devereux, I think we need to have a little conversation. And the meeting is described by Fiennes Morrison. It's an amazing scene. Essex and O'Neill agree to meet at a river on opposite sides of the river so that they can't attack each other, right? Theoretically. Okay. It's near where the town of Louth is today. And Essex is waiting down at the river, you know, with his 4,000 English soldiers saying, waiting to meet O'Neill, facing off with him, all dressed up in his Renaissance outfits and armor. O'Neill comes over the crest of a hill on a horse. And behind him come this shadow of the Gaelic army coming over the hill.
Yeah.
As this spectacular show. And he leaves them up there. He takes his horse alone. He trots his horse down to the river alone. Completely vulnerable in front of Essex's army. They could have shot him through the heart with an arrow at any moment.
Yeah.
Not only that, but he wades his horse into the water right up to its belly. So this is like a show of peace. He's making himself even more vulnerable. And it's symbolic. He's coming halfway, right across the river, right? So it's this clear symbol. It's also like this massive boss move because he's basically kind of going right up to the nose of this English general and like tickling him, basically, you know, saying like, you know, kill me. I dare you. Like, what are you going to do then? And what he manages to get out of Essex is unbelievable. He gets him to sign this humiliating peace treaty, saying that England will completely withdraw its troops from Ireland, that they will give back all the lands to the Gaelic chieftains, and most of all, most humiliatingly at all, of all, that they will allow everyone to reject the Reformation, that they won't impose Protestantism anymore, and that everyone in Ireland will get to be Catholic if they want to be.
Okay, so he just concedes everything. So like Essex turns up, just concedes absolutely everything.
Yeah, yeah, with the biggest army that had ever been sent to Ireland by England, like ever. So he completely dive bombs, and when Elizabeth finds out, she hit the roof. She writes him these letters, and you can just imagine her pacing up and down in her room, you know. These ones are really interesting because you can really hear that she is freaking out. Like, they have spent so much money on this, and they have got precisely nowhere. And like, this was their last trump card, basically, or so it seemed. Here's a short quote from her letter to Essex. I'll send it to you now. She's referring to herself, by the way, with a royal we. So when she says we here, she means I, just to avoid confusion.
Right. Okay, so here's Elizabeth. "We find in your letters a course more strange, if stranger may be. You have ever possessed us with expectations that you would proceed as we directed you, but your actions show always the contrary. We require you to consider that all the petty undertakings in Leinster, Munster and Connacht are but losses of time, consumption of treasure, and wastes of our people, until Tyrone himself be beaten. Do you not see, the wars are like to spend us and our kingdom beyond all moderation? What you have done is past our comprehension, especially since you, by your continual reports of the state of every province, describe them all to be in worse condition than ever they were before you set foot in that kingdom."
At this stage, she knows that he signed a truce. And she tells him in other parts of the letter, she says, "We didn't send you to end the war. Like, this is this was not your mission. Your mission was not to get a truce. Your mission was to crush these people."
Right.
And of course, at the same time, O'Neill's strategy for framing the war as like a holy war of Catholic Europe against Protestantism, this was working. At this point, O'Neill had managed to obtain a bull of indulgence from the Pope. That meant that any Catholic who joined the war would be absolved of their sins. So it gave everyone just this huge motivation to join O'Neill's side, including the Old English, even though most of them didn't still.
Right. No, like, including like the most sin-steeped murderous person. If you join the war, you would be cleansed of all your sins. Yeah.
That's the idea. Yeah. This is a thing that was used for the Crusades. This idea of kind of crusading indulgence, right? So that you join a holy war and that will get you into heaven directly if the Pope says so. I mean, this is exactly what kind of what Protestants hated about Catholicism, of course, you know, this kind of bureaucratic kind of cynical stuff that they did here for money and political power. But this is what was happening. The Pope actually did something really jaw-dropping. He sent A. O'Neill a gift. The gift was a crown of peacock feathers. Pretty great gift. That would be a cool gift on its own. But this was a symbol because the very first Norman king of Ireland, all the way back in the 12th century, when he had declared himself Lord of Ireland, the first lordship of Ireland, the Pope at that time had given him his blessing for taking the lordship of Ireland. And he had confirmed that blessing by gifting that very first Norman king a crown of peacock feathers. So now, 400 years later, he's sending the same symbol to A. O'Neill, saying, "This is for you now."
Okay, fascinating. So the Pope is effectively, the Pope is like emperor type figure at this point, right? Like, he's like, he's not like the Pope we talk about today. Like, he's got lands, armies. He's like a big power force. And he's effectively recognizing A. O'Neill, the Gaelic chieftain, as Lord of Ireland instead of one of these like old Norman Hiberno Irish guys, Norman guys.
Or instead of Elizabeth, who would have.
Or instead of Elizabeth. Like,
Elizabeth was the Queen of Ireland, according to herself. Right. But at this point, Elizabeth had been excommunicated, of course, by the Vatican. So therefore, she didn't have any claim in their eyes to Ireland anymore. So he's doing this in a symbolic way. He's being very careful not to make anything official, the Pope, at this point, because there's all kind of politics in here that we can talk about during the debrief that make it complicated. And the peacock also, there's another symbol here. The peacock was associated with the phoenix. So a lot of documents describing this incident don't describe it as a crown of peacock feathers, but a crown of phoenix feathers. So this symbol of like the Gaelic clans rising from the ashes, you know.
Wow. Okay, so what happened to Essex, who's disappointed Elizabeth so much?
Okay, so much happens. It's actually so dramatic, but again, zero time to talk about it. So that's for the debrief. You can tune in on Patreon. I might mention that right now. You can find all of these Patreon debriefs over on our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/theirishpassport, where we have over 100 of extra content, things like this for you to listen to if you're interested. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in a nutshell, Essex flees Ireland. His campaign is a failure, as we saw. Elizabeth has to find someone new. And she settles on this other favourite at court. It's like Essex's frenemy, this guy. Like, they had always been rivals since they were kids. His name is Charles Blunt, and he was otherwise known as Lord Mountjoy. And he's the one who employed Fiennes Morrison as his personal secretary.
Okay.
Fiennes Morrison is in love with this guy. Like... He is in love with him. The way he writes about him is properly unhinged. He has a full-on crush on him. The quotes are hilarious. I noted them all down and I wanted to talk about them in the main episode, but they go on and on and on. So I will also talk about those in the debrief, but it's hilarious. Fiennes Morrison loves him, but this guy is... He basically brings back a tried and tested way of dealing with this. He says only one thing has worked against the Gaelic Irish, and that was scorching the earth. So we need to do that again, and we need to do it quick. He lands his troops at Derry, and they embark on a wide-scale campaign of crop burning in an attempt to weaken the populace of Tyrowen. So he wants to weaken the heartlands of Ulster now. And here is Fiennes Morrison, his personal secretary, boasting about how brilliant and inspired this method of systematic starvation was. So I'm going to send you that quote there.
Where other Lord Deputies used to assail the rebels only in the summertime, Mountjoy prosecuted them most in the winter. This broke their hearts, for the air being sharp and they naked, and being driven from their lodgings into the woods bare of leaves, they had no shelter for themselves. Besides that, their cattle were also wasted by driving to and fro, and that they being thus troubled in the seed time could not sow their ground. In harvest time, both the deputies' forces and the garrisons cut down their corn before it was ripe. In the winter time, they carried away or burnt all the stores of victuals in secret places where the rebels had concealed them. Oh my God, it's awful. Mm.
Yeah, so in the context of what he's writing here, he's saying, you see, all the others should have done that. You know, look at how clever Mountjoy is. Again, they're really shameless about doing this. And like, this was just a really underhanded and kind of awful thing to do, even at the time. Now, unsurprisingly, targeting civilians, starving people out in the winter, taking their food stores away, etc., it worked. It guaranteed the English the upper hand once again. But just as their luck seemed to be turning around, just as Ulster was being scorched to the ground, suddenly the Spanish arrive.
We need like trumpet or something.
Da-da-da-da. Exactly. Yeah, so
that's what I'm thinking.
This is a... Like, this is a famous episode in this whole history, because this is a make-or-break moment. O'Neill had been waiting on this since the beginning of the war, and it happens in 1601. Philip of Spain assented. He sent one of his generals, Juan de la Aguila, with 33 ships and an army of over 4,000 men to Ireland to fight with O'Neill. More people would come in, like replenishments, so a few thousand more would come later on. And a bunch of these ships straight away, same old bloody story, a bunch of them get caught in a storm and have to turn back.
Right.
But most of them make it to the southern coast of Ireland and they take control of the coastal town of Kinsale. Now, this was a bit of a random choice for invasion. It was mainly because of the weather that the Spanish settled down in Kinsale. Normally, you would go to Galway because the winds, the trade winds, naturally bring ships from Spain to Galway. And if they had taken control of the city of Galway, they would have been surrounded by Gaelic clans to help them. It would have been kind of perfect. But at this stage, there was a lot of English in Munster and Kinsale wasn't a great choice. But even worse, it was the furthest place they could really be from O'Neill. Because Mountjoy was scorching the earth up in Ulster, in the north of the island, all of these clan chiefs from Ulster had gone back to Ulster to try and defend it. They had to stay there and try and defend their territories and use their armies to do so. And the Spanish were literally on the other side of the island, right down on the southern tip.
Yes, exactly. So if you were to calculate the route, like on Google Maps, going from Kinsale up to the northeast is about the longest journey you can do on the island of Ireland. They're like seriously far. It's the very northern and southern ends of the island.
Yes. And Mountjoy sees this and he sees his chance. So he takes a gamble and he pretty much withdraws all of his troops from the garrisons around the Pale, where most of them are. And he sends the big guns in. He sends about 10,000 soldiers down to lay siege to the town of Kinsale.
Okay.
And this forces O'Neill into a bind. He has two options. Number one, he can come to rescue the Spanish troops in Kinsale, hopefully liberate them, and then he'll have this Irish-Spanish front that he can lead against Mountjoy's army. Everything will go to plan. But to do this, he and his allies will have to abandon their territories in Ulster, first of all, to be scorched and destroyed. And he will have to march his army the entire length of the country in the dead of winter and face strategic resistance from Mountjoy every step of the way. This was almost guaranteed to decimate his forces and severely weaken just the Gaelic side in general.
Yes.
But option two was to stay in Ulster, and this would mean abandoning the Spanish assistance that the whole war effectively depended on at the end of the day. And he could be pretty sure that if the Spanish were killed or if they were forced to flee, then they wouldn't come back. You know, like Philip would have said, we sent you troops and you didn't even come to get them. You wouldn't have seen any more troops arriving from Spain again.
So like two bad options, basically. And this part is famous because O'Neill chooses the first course of action. He marches his army southward to Kinsale. And this leads to the defining battle of the whole war.
Yeah, this scenario was actually worse than anyone imagined. This winter in 1601 was incredibly harsh, with severe snow and ice just everywhere blanketing the country. On both the English and the Irish side, soldiers were dropping dead from cold and disease at this huge rate. And in January 1602, O'Neill's army took the risk and they went and attacked English forces that were sieging Kinsale, and they were destroyed. O'Neill's army was just completely destroyed. They had to retreat. All the Gaelic armies were dispersed. They tried to get back to Ulster, but that meant travelling again all the way up the length of Ireland through this bitter winter, and huge amounts of them died along the way. Now, in the meantime, the Spanish surrendered at Kinsale. So that was that over. That dashed any hopes of a Spanish-Irish alliance suddenly and forever. And with that, basically, everything fell apart in this one moment. His allies began to splinter. Ulster was falling now into a devastating famine because of the crop burning. And O'Neill and his allies fled into the woods. It's kind of fascinating at this stage. He was so hated in England. Remembered the effect that this has had in England economically and politically. He was so hated in England that he became lore. He became a myth in parts of England. So in local lore in parts of England, like Lancashire and in Devon, there are still memories of A. O'Neill. In fact, still today, there is a whole 3-day festival that takes place in the English county of Devon every year where locals symbolically dress up and hunt A. O'Neill. And then they symbolically capture him, humiliate him and murder him. It's completely wild. It's so wild and I'm dying to talk about it. But again, no time. So you're going to have to tune into the debrief to get that content, I'm afraid.
I had no idea. Okay, I can't wait to hear more.
That's not the only one. There's like other local lore in England about A. O'Neill anyway. Yeah.
What did they call him again? Was it the Great Traitor? What was their name for him?
The Arch Traitor.
The Arch, that's it. Right. Yeah. So it's a bit like a kind of Guy Fawkes type thing, except he's completely like this Gaelic.
And around the same time. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, can't wait to get into that. So the Battle of Kinsale, was this the end of the war?
Effectively, yes, but technically no. Elizabeth decided not to accept surrender from O'Neill because that would mean that now she has justification for more violent incursions. So as long as this war is going on, the incursions into Gaelic Ireland can continue in this like high violence. So Mountjoy returns to Ulster and he extends the scorched earth policy. He says, burn more, just keep burning.
Oh God.
So he and his generals completely devastate pretty much the entire province of Ulster. They provoke a famine that killed approximately 60,000 people. So we saw that the Munster famine was 50,000, but that included the people dead in the Desmond Rebellion through war. This is 60,000 from famine alone. It's enormous. It was so huge that it caused economic collapse, not just in Ulster, but all over Gaelic Ireland. The whole Gaelic economy collapsed, and a state of starvation became generalized across the whole country at this point. And during this time, Mountjoy took his army to Tulloch Og, that famous inauguration site of the O'Neills, where the O'Neills had been claiming their rights over Tyrowen for since before recorded history, for at least a millennium. Yeah. And he smashed Lochnarea, he smashed the Coronation Stone into a million pieces, symbolically ensuring that there would never again be a Taoiseach of the O'Neill.
Oh my God. It's so tragic.
Yeah.
And famously, of course, O'Neill himself fled Ireland.
Yes, he finally surrendered in 1603, and he actually got off really, really lightly because, luckily for him, Elizabeth died that same week. She actually died the same week that he surrendered. And the new monarch, James I, wanted to tread super lightly with the Irish situation. He didn't want to make any martyrs or anything. So he allowed O'Neill to live, and he even allowed O'Neill to retain his title, the Earl of Tyrone. Like, his earldom was still there, which is amazing that they allowed him to keep that. But of course, you can imagine him going back to that scorched earth and seeing the smashed inauguration stone is like, what is there to come back to? You know, really, what is accepting this English title again, you know? Like, the whole world of Gaelic Ireland was basically kind of gone up in smoke in an instant. From this point on, the Brehon laws were completely abolished across the island forever. The Fili, those poets class, they were banished completely. And English law was now established in every corner of Ireland. And most consequentially of all, that hugely scorched and depopulated terrain of Ulster was this empty territory now. It was this perfect terrain for James I's big new colonial project, the plantation of Ulster, which would, of course, change the course of Irish history forever. So that's what lays the ground for the plantation of Ulster, this scorching of the earth during the Nine Years' War.
Wow.
So in the years after 1603, we have these like kind of radicals moving into power in England, the Puritans, who we'll talk about in future episodes, people who are not going to be treating Irish Catholics in any ways lightly and may like invade really at any moment. We have things happening like the gunpowder plot in England, where there's this huge anti-Catholic sentiment growing after Catholics tried to blow up Parliament over in London. So it's not looking good for O'Neill and these surviving Ulster chiefs, even though they've surrendered. So a lot of them, a whole bunch of them just desert Ireland. They just flee. Nobody knows exactly what they were planning to do. It's possible they were hoping to shore up one last attempt at resistance with help from European armies.
That's what I thought they were doing. I thought they had plans that they would go and appeal to the Catholic powers and like return with armies. I thought that was their idea.
Yeah, that seems likely. It seems the most likely idea, but there's lots of historians have lots of different ideas about what exactly they were up to. Whatever happened, that didn't materialize. As it happened, O'Neill and A. Rua and A. Maguire, these people were the last Gaelic leaders of Ireland ever. And when O'Neill died in Rome in 1616, in many ways, Gaelic Ireland died with him.
What a story, Tim.
Yeah.
And of course, it isn't the final chapter. Mm-mm. There's still more to come in this history and in the Conquest series. And don't forget, we will be putting up bonus content, including a debrief for this episode, many more bonus episodes as well over on Patreon, which is where you can sign up as a subscriber to keep the podcast going. We hugely appreciate it. It's the backbone of the podcast. And there's a huge amount of bonus content over there to delve into. So, listeners, we're going to leave you with the beautiful voice of Gráinne Smith singing that famous song of Gaelic resistance, O Ro Shedaba Avalia.
Gráinne told us that she sometimes sings this as a lullaby to her two young children, Róisín and Hazel. So this episode goes out to them. Maybe they'll sing this song to their own babies one day. And in that way, at least a piece, if even just a very tiny piece of old Gaelic Ireland might live on. Slán, everyone.
Slán.
Roshe the vaho walya, anisher hochtan tauri. She the vaha van Berlin, ver the bear grach to ve ing even the rehevro, his shell of merlach. Is to jil talesh na golev. O Roshe the Vahawalya, O Roshe the Vahawalya, O Roshe the Vahawalya, Anisher Hochton Tauri. Tá gráinne bhile ag teach tar sáile, óglaí armthe leithí mar ghair de gaolaid féin is ní gá na spáinní. Is curí siad ruig ar gálaib. Ó Roshe the Vahawalya, Ó Roshe the Vahawalya, Ó Roshe the Vahawalya. An isher hochton tauri. A wheelerin of yard go vecum, a ramean bio in a year, ach shachten groan you wail, is meal a gosh gilch, egg fogert von ergolif. O Roshe the Vahawalya, O Roshe the Vahawalya, O Roshe the Vahawalya, Anisher Hochton Tauri.